You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Mott, and this is episode 003. We made it to three episodes. I know that's not a lot, but I've been moving around a lot and doing a bunch of other projects in the background, so to get to three feels pretty good, even though it's kind of a nothing number. Today we're talking with Kevin Kelly. Now, man, Kevin is known for many things. He's the co-founder of Wired Magazine. He worked with Stuart Brand on the Whole Earth catalog. He's the author of half a dozen books on technology futurism, you know, a few of which have made him even kind of a superstar in China, replete with young fans who have Kevin Kelly tattooed on their shoulders. It's kind of crazy. But I know Kevin most of all for his walking, actually. Long walks, sometimes in the city, sometimes in the countryside. Kevin walks and he photographs with a quiet deliberation and an endless curiosity and generosity of heart. And so in this episode, I speak with Kevin not about the future of technology, not about the dozen books he's written on what technology wants, but instead about his travels in Asia in the 70s, during what you could kind of call a heyday of indie world exploration.
Someone like myself, who had almost nothing, could for very little arrive in these places which really hadn't changed at all. And they were completely medieval. Cities like Kathmandu in Nepal, which was a city of, I don't know, maybe half a million, three quarters of a million people without any cars. I mean, a city without cars. There are towns in northern Afghanistan that had no electricity, not just a village. I mean, a town with electricity. So it was running with, you know, kerosene lamps being lit by a, you know, a lantern lighter at night and stuff. It was medieval in that sense, or at least pre-industrial.
Kevin shot thousands of rolls of film over the years, and in the late 90s he made a book, Asia Grace. We're gonna be talking about that today. Kevin Kelly, thank you so much for making the time to be here today. It is so good to have you here with us.
Hey, Craig. It's so great to hear your voice.
Even though we are separated by the Pacific Ocean, I feel like you're close. So, you know, I just want to jump right in to the book. You traveled extensively in your youth throughout Asia. And in 2002, many years after all of that travel, you released a book through Teshen of those travels. And I really want to dig into that today, what those travels meant and how you put this book together. So when were the bulk of the images taken? When was the bulk of that travel undertaken?
I would say most of them, and there was maybe 400 to 500 images in the book, that most were taken in the 70s, the late 70s. And there was a smattering taken in the 80s and another batch taken in the 90s, early 90s. The genesis of the book certainly took place in the 70s.
And this is when you were traveling alone through Asia for months, for years?
For years, yes. So I was a kid with a camera, and a kid with a camera was actually pretty unusual back in the 70s. We're just coming out of a time, like for instance, my own family, where there might be one camera per family, and you had a roll of film, 24 exposures, and it might take you a year.
Right.
You might take 24 images a year.
Right.
Because you get the film developed, and there'd be a picture from Easter and one from graduation, a couple from graduation, and then two or three from Halloween.
Right.
And so people were taking maybe a couple dozen images a year. When I set out with a camera taking lots of pictures, this was relatively very unusual. It was just kind of the beginning of the SLR, the single lens reflex moment, when people were just beginning to get into it and to kind of treat this seriously, meaning that you're taking a lot of pictures. I was an early photography fan, and, you know, I set off to be a National Geographic photographer and photograph Asia. Yeah. The only thing I had in my backpack was film, basically, and which you needed to bring. It was bulky and took up a lot of space, and it was very, very, very expensive relative to now. one snap of the shutter, one shot was $3 or $4, maybe even more. And so I was taking two rolls, which is 70 pictures a day. And when I told people that, they were absolutely gobsmacked, astounded, incredulous. They didn't understand how you could take 70 pictures a day.
Right.
It just seemed crazy because, as I said, they were taking maybe a couple dozen a year. So this is a completely different mindset than today's world with ubiquitous camera phones and people take 70 pictures a day without blinking. So I was doing photography at a time where it was just at the beginning of that moment in our culture when before everybody had a camera, when it still required a lot of kind of technical skill, a little bit of money. I would do a lot of the processing black and white in a darkroom myself to print the images. My travels in Asia were mostly to photograph.
Right. And as you were traveling, you had this backpack full of film. You were sort of mailing boxes of it home as you shot it to your parents.
Right. Because I didn't have enough money to process it.
Right.
So I barely had enough money to buy the film and barely enough money to travel and no money to process it. So it went home. My mom stuck it in the freezer. I, read that if you froze it, it would last. And so it would stick in the freezer until I would come home and then get a job.
Right.
And the job was, I was living at home. The job was to pay for money to get it processed. And so each time I got, got some payment, I'd send another batch to Rochester, basically. And here's the thing. I'm getting to look at these images years after I took them, which is a really, really bad way to learn. I mean, it's a very terrible feedback loop because I'm shooting blind, basically. I don't have any idea if my exposures are correct. I'm hoping that my focus is correct. You have to really pre-visualize, which was the term that the photographer Ansel Adams talked about.
Right.
You had to learn to pre-visualize what that was going to look like before you took it. Considering all that could go wrong, the fact that I didn't have an automatic focus or even automatic exposure, everything was done manually, which is another thing. I did pretty good because manually setting exposure and I'm photographing people, there's no second choice or second chance, rather.
Right.
And so it was a long process. And so, yes, I'd send the film home. I wouldn't see it until I stopped traveling, basically.
That's crazy. It's so disconnected from where we are and how we shoot today. And what kinds of film were you using? And did you have any specific techniques? Were you, shooting with the Ansel Adams zone system, for example, when you were out there in the field?
I had done the zone system somewhat in my large format black and white, but I was shooting color slide. I had two camera bodies. One had Ektachrome in, which was slightly higher speed. The other one had Kodachrome, the classic color, which is very, very slow. It was Kodachrome 64.
Okay.
64, and what we would call now today an ISO of 64.
Right.
I was shooting in natural light. I was squeezing slowly and always just at the edge of having too slow a shutter speed because 64 is nothing in terms of speed, and I'm shooting in homes or whatever. The zone system doesn't work really well with slide because you don't have control over the processing.
Sure.
Mostly what I'm trying to do is make sure that I have enough light and make sure that I don't have too much light if I'm shooting outside. So it was, I'm shooting for middle gray. I'm exposing for middle gray, basically, just in terms of the tactical thing, just trying to get it semi-meter to a middle gray and then exposing for that, which is what it does automatically. So technically, when you are shooting today with modern cameras, you have far more control over the whole pathway than you do when I did with a kind of a manual camera with slide film.
Right.
You kind of have to, you have one chance to get it correct and that's about it.
Right. Well, even just today, the dynamic range, I mean, you can miss an exposure by, two, three, four stops and still save the photo, which is kind of, it almost feels like cheating.
In the old days.
It's too easy.
Since we're talking technique, part of what I would do every couple months is I would buy some black and white film locally, send a roll through my camera, have it processed, just to be sure my camera was working, because it was a mechanical device with mechanical shutters, and there's no maintenance needed light. There's no little warning light saying this isn't working. If it stopped working, you wouldn't even know it.
Right. And what were you shooting with? Were you on a Leica, or were you carrying around a Nikon, or were you?
So I've been shooting pretty seriously for 40 some years, and I've never used a state-of-the-art camera. I was shooting a Nikkor Mat,
okay,
which was the amateur version of Nikon, because I couldn't even afford a Nikon.
Sure.
So I've never had a professional camera. The lenses were pretty generic, not very fast lenses, because I couldn't afford it either. I paid for all my travels myself. I was a kid without a career, doing hourly wages, saving up money. And so cameras were relatively expensive at that time, and even something like a Nikon was just way out of my league. I just couldn't afford it.
Right. Well, and what's kind of cool to think about is that back then they were just light tight boxes, for the most part. It's not like the pros had a more light tight box than the amateurs. And film was the sensor of that day. And if you wanted to shoot the same film, have the same sensor that the pros had, you could get it. You just got that X-Pan or you got that Kodachrome. And you were shooting on the same level that the pros were, to a certain degree.
Right. Yeah. They had a little faster lenses. Very soon they had auto advance. So they could take a couple pictures in a rapid succession and things like that. But yeah, you're right. There was a far more equitable difference between, an amateur and a professional. And so I wasn't hurt, that much. But the other way of saying that is I would have died to have a camera. The cheapest camera that you can buy today would have been just completely insane back then.
Right.
So I shoot today with a point and shoots. I use point and shoots. And first of all, for the kind of work I do with people, they're silent, which is like a huge thing, because I'm not disturbing people. Maybe they don't even know I'm shooting. It's fast. The sensors and these things are just amazing. And they're cheap because I'm not carrying film around and I can take as many pictures as I want. And the clarity of the digital is so crisp and clear, and the colors are so vibrant. They really do. They don't fade. And that's another issue that I've had with the film was if it gets a little hot or even a lot of hot, the film can start to be affected and over time, definitely affected. Even when the Kodachrome was fresh, it did not capture the colors as vividly as I think the digital sensors. And that's my opinion. In every way, digital photography today is miles superior to film. And, if you want to make a film look, I can add a filter and get that film look on a digital file. But you can't go the other way around. You can't have film make it look like digital. So anyway, I lugged, two camera bodies, five lenses, 500 rolls of film in my backpack. was what photography was. It was very laborious, I would say.
Well, and then like you said too, it's like you're not learning in the moment, right?
Yeah,
because it's
you're
like, okay, I can write down the f-stops for each of the slide numbers if I wanted to, and then like go back to that and reference it when I get the stuff developed. But if you're getting it developed years later,
it's not
a very tight feedback loop. Yeah.
The story really is one of hardship and difficulty. And I was there doing that for 8 years or so for first time around, over the period of 8 years of coming back to work in between to earn money to keep going. So it wasn't a single trip. I was having to earn money in between and living, of course, extremely cheaply. But the one other thing I would say about that general time in my life and in the world of photography was it was an incredibly special, exceptional, never to be repeated event in the history of this planet, which was by the end of the 60s and maybe until the 80s, through large parts of the world, somebody with very little money like myself could enter into areas of the world that had not changed since the medieval era.
Right.
previous to that time, if you wanted to mount an expedition to go into Tibet or, you know, into Afghanistan or somewhere, you needed to have some means. You needed to be someone with money and connection. No ordinary person could just sort of venture on because there was no support. There was no maybe even getting visas. You needed permission. You needed all kinds of things. But then the world began to change in the late 60s and early 70s. Someone like myself, who had almost nothing, could for very little arrive in these places, which really hadn't changed at all. And they were completely medieval. Cities like Kathmandu in Nepal, which was a city of, I don't know, maybe half a million, three quarters of a million people without any cars. I mean, a city without cars. There are towns in northern Afghanistan that had no electricity, not just a village. I mean, a town without electricity. So it was running with, you know, kerosene lamps being lit by a, you know, a lantern lighter at night and stuff. It was medieval in that sense, or at least pre-industrial. And then shortly after that, the world began to change very rapidly. And of course, anybody could visit anywhere, but had been transformed. But there was a decade or two where it had not yet transformed and it was accessible. Right. And I was traveling during that time. And so I got to enter into this time machine and see an era, just see a time when people really were living in a way that we would find very difficult to believe now. And not just materially in terms of, you know, living without electricity or plumbing, but actually their mindsets were in completely embedded in that kind of a medieval perspective, pre-industrial perspective. And they thought like that. They lived that way fully in terms of their culture and their traditions. And so I, in some ways, became really aware of the reality of progress because I had the experience of having lived in these countries and seen with my own eyes them progress 200 years worth of progress in my lifetime. And so I know that progress is real. There was this time when travel permitted someone to travel in time, not just in space.
Right. Do you think you, when you started traveling in the 70s, did you immediately pick up on that, or did you realize this years later or decades later? Or
My first trip was to Japan, of all places, or Taiwan first and Japan. I got this sense in Taiwan, but Taiwan was already somewhat leaving that era. During that same trip of Taiwan and Japan, I went to the Philippines, where I had an inclination. But it was really on my second trip to Burma, Bangladesh, India, and then the subcontinent when I had the full immersion in there and I realized it. So the answer is no, it was not evident. I didn't know that before I went out, and it was really only my second trip when I understood this. And I think while I was very appreciative and really wanted to capture it, I don't think I had an inclination of how fast it would change. Because it seemed as if, you know, it just seemed impossible that change would come to these places at any speed. If you had tried to bet me, say, in 1970, that within 30 years, the street sweepers of India would be carrying cell phones, mini supercomputers, I was like, there is no way.
Right.
That's never going to happen. Right. So I think I was surprised by the speed at which things were transformed.
Right. Well, and what's so cool about it, too, is like as you travel those countries, especially Southeast Asia, it's like everywhere on display are just people using tools, right? People using technology in kind of like funky, interesting, creative ways.
It was all transparent, all out in the open. The sense of privacy is very, very much different from the West. So I would boldly wander onto people's fields, into people's homes, barns, whatever it was, looking to see what was going on, and you could see how things were done, and you could see the new coming in as well. So that was the other lesson, was this education in how things happen, how the world works, because everything was on the street, basically, or at least open in a kind of a garage way where you could just see how things were done. So to kind of tie in a little bit about this travel and the book was, I was on a self-assignment. By my second trip, I kind of knew what I was doing, which was to document this stuff, because I knew that it wasn't going to be there forever. I could see that. I didn't realize it was going to disappear so fast, but I could tell it was going to disappear.
Right.
So I started to document it, in part, not out of any sense of nostalgia of trying to prevent it from happening, but just because there was a certain beauty to it. I always imagined it as a book. Again, this was a different time when to do a book of your photographs, there was, you know, maybe five nationally famous photographers who could sell enough books to who were famous enough to justify a photo book. Mm. And so the possibility of me, who had, you know, I was an absolute nobody, of having a book of my own was just a kind of, it was a dream, right? That was just like, well, someday, you know, I came back, I got a job in publishing of all things. And the images, while I still added to them every year, were still sitting there waiting for something. And then gradually, I would say at about the days of Wired in the 90s, I realized that the tools for making a book were now accessible to me. And I didn't have to wait to get permission, basically, and so that I could do it myself, that I could prepare a book, you know, with my own labor. And again, the thing about a photo book, it isn't just that you can type some words and put out photos. Had this elaborate process of the reproductions, of making the halftones, of having to tweak and optimize the color separations, they were called. It was a very, very expensive process that, I mean, literally was like thousands of dollars per image in the past.
Right, right, right.
That was the cost of preparing an image for printing, was thousands of dollars per image. And so, so that cost, and that's not even talking about, say, the designer and the typographers and everything. So all of a sudden, the new tools of self-publishing made that within reach.
And when you say the new tools, you mean things like Quark or Photoshop?
Yeah, Photoshop and Quark were basically the originals. And I saw that from Wired, in our Wired days, where Wired was very early to adopt these tools to produce a color magazine. We were outside, because we were just a startup, we were outside the whole publishing, printing business industry, which still had a lot of old-fashioned, quality-first demands that we were ignoring and still getting great results. So I saw with my own eyes that Wired could print state-of-the-art photography using Quark and Photoshop.
Right, and a light went off, bing.
Bing. Oh. It's like, okay, I could do this book. And the way I'll do it is I will do the book. I will do all the work. I will do all the photo separations. I will do all the, you know, the preparation, the layout, the design, and I will print it out and I will prepare everything. And all they have to do is print it.
Right.
Like we do with the magazine, going to the printer. That was the solution. And so it was because when I submitted my book to Tashin, I was basically a photographic nobody. I had very little published. I had a couple pieces in Life, I had a couple pieces in some magazines here and there, but I didn't really have a reputation as a photographer. I didn't have a huge portfolio, and I certainly didn't have a name. But what I did have was a completed book,
right,
that was ready to be printed, that looked gorgeous, and so it was very hard to say no to.
Right. I like that you presented them with this option that would just have been stupid to turn down. Everything is done. Everything is done.
It didn't need any translation because Tashin's a German publisher. It didn't need translations. It didn't need really anything. It didn't need proofing. It was just really ready to be printed.
And how did you put it together? Did you put it together in your library in your house in Pacifica, or were you using the Wired offices? Or
no, I actually had a little shed in the backyard. Had my studio there. It was literally, I don't know, 10 feet by 10 feet. I mean, it was really tiny. It had no heat, which was a issue during the winter. And I had a Mac Plus. No, a Fat Mac. A Fat Mac. Yeah,
a Fat Mac. I had
a 10 meg disk. I was very, very, but you know, I had to save to these floppies and things. It was a very, you know, doing a whole book on, on this, and I had my slides scanned at a scanner that did something, weren't high res because I couldn't afford it. They were called for position only. They were basically low res versions. They were done cheaply for a couple dollars a piece, and they were meant just for position only. But
sure,
I also knew that for about the size that I would be publishing in the book, that they were probably going to be sufficient.
Right.
I wasn't going to blow them. I didn't need the super high res, which we today would not be super high res. It would be kind of like, you know, the ordinary thing.
Sure.
I hated Quark the entire time we were using it wired. I made the very early jump to InDesign when the first version of InDesign, just because, well, InDesign was just a better interface. And I wasn't master of Quark, so I wasn't losing all the implicit knowledge that Quark people hated to lose, even though InDesign was better, because I was starting fresh.
InDesign was just, it was more visual. Like it was actually representative of what you were going to get in a way that Quark wasn't. I was at the very tail end of Quark's kind of reign, and I used it for one semester and then switched over to InDesign.
Right.
What I love about this whole story and your adventures here is that it's just kind of a set of hacks upon hacks upon hacks.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the 70s when you were traveling, like you said, it was this kind of golden age of you don't need a lot of cash in a way that you would have 100 years before, 50 years before, 30 years before, where it would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars of equivalent cash to go on these adventures. And then once you arrived, the cost of day-to-day wasn't that high.
You know,
like you said, film was the biggest expense. And then being at Wired and realizing, oh, there's this publishing set of hacks I can tap into as well.
Yeah, it'd be equivalent of like, you know, taking your Canon and making a movie that appears on Netflix.
Right.
You know, getting a Netflix original that you shot with your Canon.
Right.
You know,
right.
Somebody's going to do that if they haven't already. And you don't need $1 million to do these things. And there's always going to be these hacks that you can kind of work around, because, you know, a lot of what these professional tools and the professional qualities give you are insurance. So you can achieve similar results if you are willing to have to redo things or to accept a certain cut that a professional wouldn't, or accept a shortcut or something, some imperfection. But people are a little bit more forgiving than professionals think.
Right.
And so professionals are often, you know, trying to please themselves, which is perfectly reasonable.
Sure, yeah.
But things that look handmade often have a certain allure to themselves too. And that's another thing.
One of my favorite movies, you know, the last 20 years is Primer. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
So Primer is this incredible sci-fi movie about time travel. It all takes place in a garage, basically, in Texas.
Yeah.
And the whole movie, it was scored, it was shot, it was written, and the main actor, it's all the same person.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's
phenomenal. I think we're going to see more of that. I think we're just at the beginning of that. I think the tools of, and I think people will go into VRs and start to film in other worlds of people, in worlds that they haven't made that are available to them in some ways.
Sure.
So I think the era of the auteur, the amateur filmmaker, we haven't yet entered into that space, but we will. And it'll be really almost as easy to make a film then as to make a photo book, say, now.
Well, and when you were doing Asia Grace, so that came out in 2002. You were putting it together in 99, 2000, 2001, around there. So, I mean, obviously back then there was no Kickstarter, there was no Patreon. There was no real, I mean, there was sort of print on demand, but not really for a photo book like that.
Right.
And so your option was, okay, I spend a summer kind of putting this thing together, using the hack of low res, cheaper images, and get it all designed using InDesign, send it to Teshen, say, hey, the book is done. You guys want to publish it? And they said yes, and they put it out.
Right.
That's one process. Like if you had all the data today and from tomorrow you're like, all right, I'm going to make this book. How would you do it today versus how you
doing it. I am doing it today. I'm doing a second Asia book, and my first choice is to go back to Tashin, and I'm doing it very similar where I'm doing the entire thing. But this time, actually, this book is going to be even bigger. I mean, it'll be insanely huge. So I'm going to kind of a little bit like, I'll make something that is, it's a beautiful artifact, that it is a very large, huge experience, heavy, maybe a little unwieldy, but when you open up the pages, you have a billboard that you're looking at. You're looking right. into a huge window.
Right.
In between, have done a couple of Kickstarter books, also very high production values, lots of color, lots of paper and stuff. But I did that model of the Kickstarter, and so Asia Grace, I'm going through this process of okay, what does it want to be for this book? I am going to go back to Tashin in part because while I could kickstart it, Tashin is an art book empire, and they will get the book into a lot of places beyond my circle of friends, and I can still point those fans to, you know, Amazon or wherever, and so they still have it. I won't have the control over some aspects of the distribution, but Tashin will get it far wider than I could. And right. so since I am trying to maximize the reach, it's not a book for everybody, but the real trick these days is to find those true fans.
Right.
You know, there's, by my calculation, whatever you are interested in the world, there's going to be at least 1 in a million people
right.
who it appeals to. And if there's 1 in a million people, that means there's going to be at least 1,000 of them in the world.
Right.
And so you have to finding the 1,000 true fans or 10,000 fans, it's the real art these days. That's sort of cultivate them, you grow them, but they're still in my you know, because I'm not a full-time, I don't do this full-time. That's not my full-time thing.
Right.
I feel that there's still, you know, 10,000 people out there that I haven't yet connected with that Tashin would help me connect with.
Yeah, well, I think, and that gets, you know, that gets underestimated or that gets overlooked a lot is that, yeah, I mean, these big publishers do have this incredible reach and these incredible networks, and especially when you're talking about art books, for example, there's a lot of art bookstores out there that you are not going to be able to get it in
right.
on your own as a Kickstarter person. And
right,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Well, the thing, I was rereading your 1,000 True Fan essays, the new one and the old one last night. And I think what's so powerful about them is that they're just mathematics. Like, that's what makes them so exciting. You read it and you get energized by it because you're like, yeah, it's just math. I can inspire one person a day to kind of follow me and, you know, come on board. And in 3 years, I can have 1,000 of them and, you know, I can start putting things out. And with the ecosystem today, it feels like the big ones are Kickstarter, GoFundMe, and Patreon. Those feel, and Indiegogo, I guess. Those are like the four main ones. And what's fascinating is you referenced an older Kickstarter in your original post that was called like Fund It or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's funny that Kickstarter is the one that took off, because I think that right. this idea of patronage and microfunding had been around for a while. But now I think actually Patreon is the most exciting out of all of them. There's something about having people say, I'm opting in not to get some physical object from you all the time, but because I support the work that you're doing. And that when you put out something ephemeral, and I think this is like this is the real twist, is that you get a lot of these, going back to video and independent video production, YouTube channels today are so phenomenally fascinating. You know, the primitive technology guy, the Every Frame of Painting, and to have those Patreon fans say, look, maybe you put out a video once a month, maybe it's once every 3 months, maybe it's once a year, it doesn't matter to me. But when a video comes out, don't even ask me, I'm going to give you $5. I think that's an incredible system.
So my first, after traveling in Asia, I came back and I started a mail order travel book business, where I was selling budget travel guides, the things I had encountered on my travels that nobody else knew about, things that were very, very rare at that time. There was a publisher in Australia called Lonely Planets, and Maureen and Tony Wheeler were the people behind it. And so I was promoting these unknown books that I encountered. He had one book called Europe Through the Back Door. I was selling these things and doing a magazine about walking. But I sold those to work for a magazine called The Whole Earth Review, The Whole Earth Catalog. And what's interesting about that is that, unlike almost any other magazine in America, we carried no ads. And it was entirely subscriber-supported.
Wow.
We didn't have Patreon, but we would have if that had been available. But the power of being supported directly by your fans on a regular basis is really incredibly, it's potent. It's
freeing.
It's freeing, right? You have a bunch of people who are saying we're paying ahead.
Right.
Amaze us for the next 12 months. Okay.
Right.
You have a second customer, which is the advertisers.
Right.
And they take over. Basically, right. Those second customers right. take over. And they took over in many ways. And here's a little bit of inside stuff on the magazines. And I always objected to this, which was that when you have a magazine that you're only going to subscribers, you can do amazing things with the cover. Because
right.
the covers are all designed for magazines on the people who don't subscribe. They're right. trying to win over people who are not your fans.
Right.
And so all the people who are your fans, you're ignoring them.
Right.
That's just one of the ways in which things are warped by having an advertising base. That's one of the reasons why, I've been doing Cool Tools as a blog. 98%, 95% of our revenue is not from ads, unlike
right.
most other sites. It's Amazon affiliate, which has its own, aspects to it and problems, but it's very freeing because we don't have the customers of the advertisers to
right.
have to listen to. I think if you can escape from that, and Patreon and Kickstarter or all these things are ways to ride the power of your fans directly.
Right.
And I think it's, as you say, it's really liberating when you can do that. When you go into a publisher or a studio or label something, you don't have that direct power. Again, you have a second customer, so to speak,
right.
which is you're kind of having to please them as well. Doing something yourself directly with your customers, there's really no other medicine like it.
Right. Well, and what's so insidious about the advertising stuff online is that, like you said about the covers of magazines, online, every single page is the cover of the magazine.
Yep. Right.
Right. Every single page is the entry point. And so...
Right, exactly.
You see,
so articles are being... They have the same clickbait as covers used to.
Right, right. Everything has to be a cover now. And if trying to get people's attention, you'll do anything to get that attention. It's really sad.
And it works against the people who are already subscribers
right.
or already fans. Right.
Right. And, the thing about platforms like Patreon and Kickstarter, too, though, is that's great, is it normalizes the idea of paying for things, right? It's
yes.
like 15 years ago, doing a micropayment to someone online was kind of tough. I mean, I guess you could PayPal.
Right, right, right.
But, whatever. It wasn't automatic and, it was kind of sketchy and you didn't really know
mm-hmm.
how much money was being collected. And,
mm-hmm.
But now we've had about 8 solid years of paying creatives online for, and it's just become normal.
Right. Right.
That's really
exactly.
exciting.
Yeah, it is. So I've done books. Well, I just had a New York Times bestseller in my last book, The Inevitable, which came out in paperback.
Congrats.
That was a mainline, standard, mainstream publisher. I forget what it's called now. Penguin, Random House, Viking. It's one big thing. I used to be with Penguin and Viking. I don't, it's something else now, but it's basically the same publisher. But at the same time, I just did a book called Cool Tools that was self-published. Now, we didn't do a Kickstarter because we have this blog, which has been going on for 14, 15 years. And so there was kind of a fan base there, but it was self-published in the sense that I did all the work, hired all the work. I sent it to Hong Kong to be printed. It was sent back, and we sold it on Amazon. Again, here's another tool. So the Amazon Marketplace is another of these
totally
democratic, easy, low barrier access, because you have a global market available to you for basically nothing.
Yeah.
So that book did very well. I mean, I made more money from Cool Tools than I would have going to any publisher. And it's interesting because the reason why I self-published that originally was for speed.
Right, right.
So
right,
I came out and I wanted to have this book out for Christmas that year. And I was just finishing it in September. If I had gone to a New York publisher and said, even in the spring, if I had said I have a book I want in Christmas, they'll say, you mean Christmas next year, right?
Right.
Two
right.
years from now.
Right.
No, this coming Christmas, the one that's only 6 months away, and they would say that's literally impossible. Self-publishing, it wasn't impossible. So I could finish it in September and have it printed in Hong Kong and come back in time to be there for Christmas. So originally it was speed that was a choice, because I would have gone with a publisher because it has a better reach.
Sure.
But they were talking about, like, you know, a year and a half away. It's like, that's crazy.
Right. Well, the caveat is American publisher, right? If it's a Chinese publisher,
right,
maybe they're a little bit faster.
It is. In fact, the Chinese published my latest book. They published it before the English published it, because the same thing. They could translate it and get it into the bookstores within 6 months instead of a year and a half.
Which is amazing. Translate and publish it and get it out there.
Exactly. Right, right. So that's, but I don't want to, I mean, I think that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Time is a factor, sure, as well as expense, and that when you're thinking of these different options about making books or publication, speed is one of the huge factors. How long will this take? If I go slow, what do I get for going slow, etc.? So I for me, that's a big element in these things.
Well, an age of grace too is sort of, there's no reason to rush with it. I mean, like,
right,
you sent me that presentation that had, you know, of your recent photos, you have 230 images in there, and you frame it as it's a time machine. You've taken a time machine, Southeast Asia. You know, looking through the images, what's astounding about it is it's this incredible ethnographic and aesthetic peek into this kind of, like you say, it's like a lot. It's a world that's rapidly being lost, and you know, so there's no rush to get that out. The images are done. They're kind of frozen, and they're in place. But you said earlier something about, there was kind of a beauty of being witness to these sort of moments that you knew were fleeting. What do you think is, why is that compelling? Why does that feel beautiful?
Yeah. So like, I've spent a lot of my own money and a lot of time traveling in Asia. I'm trying to, for the second Asia book, trying to cover all the Asian countries between Turkey and Japan, which is all the Asian countries. In a certain sense, there's no reason for me to do this. There's no grand world-saving reasons. There's no economic reason. I've sure concluded recently that this is a compulsion.
Right.
This is absolute art at its basis, that I can't help but do this. It just pleases me. It may not even please others as much as it pleases me. Like, you got to watch this little show. Well, I tell you, when I watch it, I am just happy. It's like, it's all because it pleases me, and that's really why I'm doing it. Yes, this stuff is disappearing. I have no nostalgia for it. It's a lifestyle that pleasing to me to visit, but I would never want to live. And what's disappearing, it's harsh, it's unequitable, there's so many things wrong with this as a place that you would have to live your life, so that I'm not really sorry to see it go.
Right.
But there is a beauty to it that I see in it that has to do with beauty of being naked, okay? And what it's naked of is naked of all the recent... Okay, here it is. You mentioned this video of the primitive technology guy, a guy in Australia or New Zealand who is making things using... Basically, he's using stone tools to make these amazing things. There's a beauty in that it's naked in the sense that he's using nothing but what's found. And a lot of what I'm photographing has that same kind of beauty of, like, being done with the most elemental things, and yet huge variety and a gracefulness with these very, very primitive things. And so it's a similar kind of beauty of, like, how much can you do with the simplest of things, wood, fiber, you know, ground stone. You can make amazing things with this small amount, and kind of what I'm photographing is the very rich cultures that were built around the most elementary little things as tools. Right. And it's like primitive technology. He's not starting a revolution. There's nobody going back to live like that, right? I mean, there's just a kind of a beauty and that you could make a stove and make tiles for your roof just with mud in your backyard.
Right.
And that's the kind of beauty that I'm kind of exploring with these images. It's like, where they're making not just a shed in your backyard, but you're making temples. You're making entire cities that are built by hand with the same kind of mud, the same technology.
Right.
That's sort of what I'm celebrating is this. I just find it, like the primitive technology, I just find it beautiful.
Right. Well, of the 230 images you showed me yesterday, I think only four or five of them don't have people in them.
Right. For me, the ideal photograph in my books is a scene that could only have been photographed in that place. And so it's a scene that has people in a costume, in an architecture, doing something that could only have been done right there. You couldn't fake it in a studio. You couldn't make it somewhere else. It had to have happened in a very, very particular place. And the entire scene and all the, kind of in a fractal way, all the things reflect the fact that this had been taken in, you know, Tajikistan, up in the mountains, because of the clothing, the architecture, the animals, and it could have been nowhere else. People are part of that. And you also notice that most of the people were kind of in what I would call a costume. They were native things. And so it's reflecting the fact that you couldn't, and you also couldn't have taken it at a different time. You couldn't have taken it now. This could only have been taken at one place. So it's very, very distinctive by the fractal nature of the things. And people are something that's hard to fake, right? So you can't, you can't really fake that very well. One of the things I've noticed about costumes, where people get it wrong, say in movies, is that even in the most ancient time, when people were wearing clothes, every person dressed differently.
Right.
There was no uniform.
Right.
There's never been a uniform. Like, if I would go to a, you know, even 200 years ago in a random Afghan village, there'd be one guy with a vest, one guy would have a long robe, one guy would have like a overcoat, one guy would have short sleeves, one guy would have stripes, one guy would have, it's like there's no uniform. They have certain things, a certain kind of fashion grammar.
Sure, yeah.
But they're not wearing the same thing. That kind of veracity, that kind of detail would be missing if somebody tried to fake an image these days that you don't see in the images that I take.
Well, and looking at your images too, I mean, there's kind of a, almost like a, there's like a true dustiness to them too, right? Like, like it's, you can't fake the atmospheres either. And
right. Yeah.
It feels so cool. Well, when I was looking at them, I was thinking of Wim Wenders' book Written in the West, which was this photo book that he put together when he was scouting out his Paris, Texas movie. And his book only has one person in it in the whole thing. And it's otherwise just these kind of shots of storefronts or, you know, bits and pieces of these cities. And he wrote about that, that for him, the act of photographing was seeing something and recording it as if it were the last possible chance to do so, even for those most mundane moments.
Right. Another reason why I have people is I've decided there's kind of like a hierarchy of loss. Mm-hmm. There's an order in which the traditional things disappear. And the first thing that disappears is actually costume.
Huh, right.
And then the second thing that disappears will often be architecture, and then food. And the last to go is language.
Right.
And so because costume's the first to go, I take a lot of pictures of people with costumes because I could go back later and the architecture will still be there.
Right.
And if you take the people out, it'll look very similar. But once there are people in there, then you realize that it's has changed. So people is another way of kind of grounding it in this very rich time.
Right. And you think the costumes going first is just sort of like a diminishing return on time required to produce that sort of stuff? Or
I don't know. I don't know. I've been working on this other theory that we may be headed towards a global convergence.
Right.
In certain things like clothing, apartments, curriculum, media, where I was talking to Jan Tupchase about trying to design a global survey, and my little task would be to have millennial age kids around the world draw their ideal apartment.
Right.
Their ideal living space, or even maybe their ideal life. And I'm willing to kind of bet that a lot of them look very similar.
And what do you think the qualities are?
Well, I don't know. That would be the thing. Is like, you know, what are they going to include? Well, what would be in the room?
Right.
You know, the way you kind of kids draw a little house, you know, the roof and a little chimney, and there's a, you know, maybe the room has a little picture on the wall, and maybe it has a refrigerator. I don't know. That would be, that's what I'm interested to see, whether there's going to be cultural or regional differences. But it just struck me that if you take a picture of a random person on a street today, it's really hard to tell where you are. Do you know about GeoGuessr.com?
No, what's GeoGuessr?
geoguessr.com. It gives you a random place on Google Maps and you have to identify where it is. It puts you on a street and it's like, and then you get points for how close you are to the actual. It's really hard to tell in a city. It's easier to tell out in the country.
Right.
But in a city, in the urban areas, which are becoming more and more, people dress very similar from most of the world. The young people I'm talking about.
And, right, right.
Part of what my photography is about is celebrating those differences my new book is going to be called The Vanishing Asia.
Okay.
These are things that are vanishing. Again, I'm not nostalgic about them. I understand why they're vanishing. I choose to vanish them when I have a chance. But there is a beauty to those things that are vanishing. And doing traditional dress, maybe it's expensive. I don't know why people have decided to wear T-shirts all over the world.
Right.
Maybe because they're cheap, maybe because they're comfortable. I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, your point about creativity and I think your point about raw materials is really at the heart of it, right? I mean, you're witnessing this moment where people weren't connected, but they all had the same raw materials and they all had to make the same kinds of things. Like you needed a house to live in, you needed a shirt to put on to protect you from the sun or whatever, but everyone chose to do it in their own unique, creative ways.
And that was a lot to do with they didn't all have exactly the same materials. They had different weathers and climates.
Right.
And so they would use mud, but, you know, based on how often it rained, what kind of rain, how hot or dry, they would make different architecture. And the clothes were often partly influenced by the width of their looms.
Right, right, right.
What kind of materials they had to weave from, which would make different kind of clothes.
Right.
You know, the climates, whether it got cold or not. And so there was a similar set or pool of different elements to choose from. But I think what happens, technology in some ways, you know, that's the whole point of technology. It buffers us from those.
Sure.
From those localities. That's why we live in a place that gets hot in the summer and cold in winter. We don't want to be hot in the summer and cold in winter. So we use technology to make this room temperature. And if you have something at room temperature, why not make it a square box that's dry, know, because a square box really works at room temperature. And so, you know, if you can air condition, a square box, it doesn't work if you don't have air conditioning.
Right, right, right. I was hiking with a friend in December at the end of last year, and he turned to me and he said, God, you know, with all this technology, you think it'd be easier to stay warm? You know, he was cold. And I just went, are you crazy? We are able to walk anywhere in the world with like a few layers on, essentially. And our sweat is wicked away. And, you know, and when we get inside, you know, it's not arduous to take everything off. We aren't in like spacesuits. The fabrics and the technology that we have to sort of swaddle ourselves to go out in the world is so advanced today. You know, it's like, you know, you're complaining because your cheeks are cold. You know, it's not only does technology buffer us, but it also, it causes us to acclimate in a way that we forget how easy and comfortable things really are.
Yeah. And we go camping and stuff to be hot and cold and sweaty and wet. That's the entire purpose.
Right.
Is basically to remind ourselves of what we have.
Right.
You know, I think people who go camping or hiking a lot probably make that complaint less because they understand what they're getting. They understand the subsidy that we get from technology.
Right. Well, and so in your book, Vanishing Asia, you know, that costume, that kind of architecture, in a way, it's sort of a really nuanced, like, data visualization of that environment, of those people.
Yes. Right. Yeah. That was, they had a very holistic, I mean, it was a very holistic approach, and it came at great ingenuity of, I'm going to go back to this video, that primitive technology guy who has just a stone tool that you could produce such amazing things with very, very small set of tools, and using just natural muscle power is really amazing. You know, there's a huge variety that came out of that, again, depending on the circumstances. And the other thing, too, I realized about costumes and looking at historical stuff is there was fashion even like 1,000 years ago, meaning that they changed. The costumes changed over time, not like centuries, but like decades,
right,
people would be wearing something, and then the next decade they wouldn't be, and they, you know, they would be pointing to the people who were a decade behind. And so all these traditional costumes, and we think of traditional costumes, were in tremendous flux.
Right.
They aren't static at all. And what is traditional is just really traditional for some time period, whether, you know, whether it's in the 1700s or the 1500s or the 1000. And that was another kind of a shock, is that people had fashion even back then.
Right. Well, and maybe that's part of what is so beautiful about bearing witness to that, is like, you know, it's this weirdly fundamental human thing to care about aesthetics, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and there's function to it, but once the function has been settled, we go deep into the aesthetic realm for whatever reason.
Right. We have aesthetics in books and other things in photography. All the arts have styles which you can kind of often date things, because it's very hard to escape that fashion.
Hmm. Right. When is Vanishing Asia set to launch?
It's not set to launch right now,
okay.
Meaning that it's still even too early to have a date. I'm wrestling. I've been doing some designs. But the other cool thing that has advanced in terms of tools that are available, when I submitted my work to the first Asia book, I gave an inkjet printout, which did not have a true correspondence with what was going to be printed. But these days, the color space and the color management systems have become so sophisticated, even again for the layperson, for you and me, that I had an offer of the tech guy to National Geographic to do some proofs for me at National Geographic of some of my test pages, which I had also proofed at FedEx or Kinko's, and they were exactly the same.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, right, exactly. So you take it down to, you know, and have them do their best quality thing, and that's exactly what's going to be printed.
I think that just says more about the state of National Geographic than...
maybe it does. No, that's another tool that has moved in where you, and I know this from doing Cool Tools and Silver Cord and other books that were printed in Hong Kong. We can now get a pretty good idea of how to pre-visualize what it actually looked like when it's been printed.
Right.
And also the printing quality has continued to increase to be very, very consistent, to match what your proofs look like. I'm only mentioning that because that's the stage I'm in. I'm just in terms of, I'm designing the pages, the design of the pages, proofing, making the workflow, getting the color correction. And I have at least a year's worth of work to design these pages.
Wow. And how many photos in total are you culling from?
There'll probably be close to 10,000 images in the book.
Oh my God. In the book?
In the book.
Oh my God.
And so I've already color corrected, processed probably about 9,500 of them.
Oh man.
You know, I have, you know, whatever it is, maybe I have 10% to do better or to tweak or whatever. So right now it's placing, so each page will have a lot of images on them. Each page will look different than every other page. So it'll be like about 800 pages or
okay.
something.
Oh my God.
Every page will be different. And they'll also have captions for every image. So there's a lot of writing. So it's a ways away. And why am I doing this? Because I have to.
Right.
There's no logical reason to it. And if Tashin doesn't want to do it, then I'll probably go to Kickstarter. If Kickstarter doesn't want it, I'll print out two copies.
Right.
One for myself and one for my family. I'm going to do it no matter what, because I have to do it.
Well, that's the only way you can get through 10,000 photo edits.
Yes. Because it doesn't make any sense any other way.
Right. Well, I think that's a good note to end on, a note of, obsessive creative need and artistic desire. But thank you so much, Kevin, for making time to talk today. It's been a real pleasure.
Hey, yeah, it was really great. I love talking about photography and books and with you, Craig, about anything. And, you know, it was a real delight. Let's do it again.
Kevin and I recorded that back in July, a few months before this episode aired, and it just took me a while to kind of get through it all because, I don't know, I wanted to do justice to what was there. It's just me putting this thing together in my closet, literally. I'm sitting in my closet right now. It's sponsored by air and by pizza, which enters my body plus coffee and allows me to produce this thing. You know, I'm kind of learning all of this as I go along and, you know, sort of roping my friends into being on this thing. If you want to help out supporting this podcast, if you think it's interesting, if you're enjoying it, one of the biggest things you could do is just go to iTunes and rate it for me. Just go in there, and if you can write a comment, write a review, that'd be huge. I know it's the worst program in the world. I know it's so painful to go in there and rate something or comment on something, but it would mean a lot. And thank you to everyone who has reached out to me. I've gotten a lot of letters. I've gotten a lot of DMs and messages and all sorts of random vectors of thank you, which are much appreciated because podcasting kind of feels like you're yelling into the abyss a little bit. The metrics are pretty weird. All the tools feel like I'm doing web development in 1996, but it's kind of interesting. And I think the show is getting better. And so all of your encouragement means a lot. Every little bit. And Bob, thank you so much. And we will catch you next time. See ya.